Marshall here. Welcome back to The Realignment. My guest on the show today is Natalie Foster. She's the co-founder of the Economic Security Project and the author of a newly released book, The Guarantee: Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy. Natalie played a huge role in the universal basic income experiments in the 2010s in California. And during the COVID pandemic, she played a large role in supporting the intellectual work that led to the expansion of the child tax credit, a policy decision which halved child poverty in the United States. Now, with The Guarantee, she's arguing that the left should fill the void in the American economic system post-2016, post-2008 financial crisis, and of course, post-COVID, with additional guarantees that would provide economic security. Everything from higher education to healthcare to housing, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Along with discussing those guarantees and how she thinks there's an opening for new economic ideas in this country, I wanted to focus on how she thinks inflation and fears of its return and continuance in certain circumstances will play a role in limiting the ability of the left to come up with new ideas that could involve more spending. Especially as Joe Biden looks at his bad inflation numbers in the polls, this is going to be an incredibly relevant issue to look at, not only this year, but moving forward. Hope you all enjoy this very helpful conversation. Huge thank you to the Foundation for American Innovation for supporting the work of this podcast. Natalie Foster, welcome to The Realignment.
Great. So great to be here with you, Marshall.
I'm really pumped to chat with you. As listeners know, thanks to our support from the Hewlett Foundation's Economy Society program, every 3 to 4 to 6 months or so, I love to do a conversation on neoliberalism and the evolving natures of the economic and political paradigms that kind of set the agenda for all of us. That said, neoliberalism episodes have a real danger of getting a little too wonky. So Natalie, I'm just going to like set up what I think the core idea of what we're discussing here today is, and you could like respond, disagree, agree, et cetera. So for me, the core idea of this conversation in your book is that the 1980s and late 1970s beyond, America's dominant economic policy consensus has been market neoliberalism. However, you're arguing that that policy consensus is essentially breaking down, which has given an opportunity for new entrants, left, right, center, to propose new policies, new paradigms, like new ideas that can actually forge a new consensus. The submission you're entering into the discourse here, obviously, is focused on guarantees from government, really setting floors for citizenship. Would you agree with that characterization of the project and the way you're thinking about this?
Yeah, I think you've nailed it. And that it is not just pie in the sky, it is actually happening. That I trace, you know, I take 7 guarantees, things like family care, health care, guaranteed inheritance, known as a baby bond, and show how far they've moved over the last 12, 15 years across 3 presidential administrations, and how the groundwork was laid for a moment like the pandemic, where those ideas could be picked up and moved forward. So they aren't coming out of nowhere. It is not, you know, just a bunch of white papers anymore. It's here, it's happening, and it's possible in the US.
So in a way, you're doing the helpful work of proving that there really is an economic policy realignment beyond just the pie in the sky hypothetical. If we're having this conversation in 2015, 2016, we could kind of see these little threads. We could see these little tremors. You obviously are going to have the Trump election in 2016. You're going to have the Bernie Sanders primary. But you're really making the case here that in the 8 years since that period, there's just been tangible, real change there. So let's continue a bit unpacking the opening statement I offered, though. I'd love to just get your definition of neoliberalism and articulate what its costs and benefits were, especially focused, frankly, on the benefit side of things, because I think it's easy just to treat neoliberalism as an idea that just kind of came and there are these evil Chicago school people, but like, it was popular. It responded to issues and dynamics of the time. And I think it's actually really important that we don't just think of economic ideas as being purely about policy outcomes, but we also think about them as relating to political ideas that politicians could actually wield to see to succeed and gain power. So like, what were the costs and benefits of neoliberalism starting in the late 70s?
Yeah, well, let me start back. I mean, the way I think about it is that this is an economic framework dating back to the Mont Pelerin Society, right? Founded in 1947, and they would get together and they would write a statement of aims. It was largely about freedom and keeping government subservient to markets so that people could, so markets could be free, people could be free. And they would write this statement of aims and it would move across journalism, activism, the Chicago School, the Academy, electeds, and become a real orthodoxy. And in the late 60s and 70s, there was a lot of chaos in the world, and it would move into the mainstream and break with the New Deal orthodoxy prior to the 60s and 70s. And I really describe it, I sum it up, not for the academic audience, but for my in-laws or people reading this who are not super versed in economic policy, to say it was zero faith in the government, total faith in the market, and people left pulling themselves up by their bootstraps. And that became the story for my whole life. I'm 45 years old and, you know, was born right at the very end of Jimmy Carter's term. And that's the old, I was a high school debater in Kansas. And so, you know, I remember reading like U.S. News and World Reports and other news papers and thought, this is just how it is. This is how the American economy is. There's no other way. And it turns out that's not true. It had been really since the 60s and 70s. The economy is not like the weather. It is not something that just happens to us. It's instead, you know, a set of choices we make. And that was a set of choices that were made. And I'm going to start with the negatives first, because that's really where I've spent most of my research. You know, I think we stand in the ashes now of neoliberalism. We see household debt exploding around us really since 2008. In 2008, you know, the housing crisis, the economic fallout from that was extraordinary. 10 million Americans lost their homes. Half of Black and Latino families lost half of their collective wealth during that period. I think it became clear then that the neoliberal emperor had no clothes and that government was very invested in the markets, but in shoring up the banks and shoring up business and not supporting families in that big crisis. And so, you know, we see the effects of that all around us. We see household debt exploding. We see stagnant wages, widened income inequality. We see an immoral racial wealth gap that the period of neoliberalism did nothing for. And so I think that from 2008 on, we've been in a transition period. You see Occupy Wall Street enter the scene at that time, you know, laying bare the discontent. And to your point, in 2016, you would see two candidates, unlike any candidates before them, both Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders, who were speaking to a discontent and deep anxiety in the American electorate. And then Gary Gersel, who's written a great book on the subject, also talks about Brexit during this period and how if you'd gone to the UK in the 90s and said, hey, you guys are going to, you know, leave the EU, you would have been laughed out of the room. If you had gone to New Yorkers in the 90s and said, hey, this guy in the tabloids, this rich guy, he's going to be president of the United States, they would have laughed you out of the room. And yet those things happened in 2016. So, you know, you've had a great conversation recently with Joshua Green, the Bloomberg columnist, who's written a really good book on the rise of economic populist candidates. And I think that's where you're seeing this continue. You're seeing Warren and Sanders and AOC be post-neoliberal policymakers. So ultimately, I believe we're at a crossroads moment in America. We are determining what post-neoliberalism will look like. And so, as you point out, this book is my entrance into that space, saying it should be about guaranteeing the good life for families. And we've seen the floor of those guarantees be created over the last few years under the Biden administration. And it's a really important break from history. And it's one I want to see continue.
Yeah. So a couple questions. We'll go kind of one at a time. I've asked this question to a bunch of my guests who are arguing in favor of the idea that we're moving past neoliberalism. So here's the real question that I haven't gotten a satisfying answer from yet. I understand neoliberalism's political rise in the late 1970s to obviously stem from the collapse of the New Deal post-war consensus. And what really seemed, and obviously there are a variety of different issues that broke apart that consensus, everything from race to trust in government to the various like upheavals of the 1960s, but 1970s inflation and the inability of the right of the left, of the center, to come up with a comprehensive answer to that question for almost a decade really seems to have been the policy reality that provided neoliberalism with an opportunity, not just as an economic policy project, but as a political project, to enter in and say, hey, the market, economic growth, monetary policy, those are by the means which we could assure prosperity and mourning in America, not just another government program. So we've just had 2 years, not just of inflation, because obviously inflation started to go down, but a political moment where I promise you, every single smart center left, center right, basically any politically engaged person holding office, running for office, is thinking, how do I make the case, if you're a Republican, that Joe Biden's the cause of inflation, or if you're a Democrat, that we have a set of policies that will reduce inflation? That doesn't seem to me to be a period that's going to promote a flowering of post-neoliberalism. Instead, there's this real chance, especially if Biden loses re-election, that you're going to have a generation of center-left and center-right people who basically say to themselves, look, the really aggressive governmental response to COVID may have been meritorious when it came to its policy responses, but at a political level, Biden just couldn't recover from it. And we need to do every single thing we can to reduce the perception that we are these big government spenders, aka it's 1982 all over again. What is your response? As someone who works with politicians, that's why I find your work so interesting. How do you interpret the dilemma I've sort of established here?
I think that is just such an astute question, and one that certainly keeps me up at night. The other thing I'll say is that nothing is preordained. We're recording this in April. There will be the election in November. That's a political lifetime between now and then. And so there's a lot of work to do. And the work to do is to make the case that this election is the contest for the future, and make the case that there has been, you know, a set of things done in the past, yes, but this is about the future. This is about where we're heading. This is about guaranteeing a floor so that people can live their lives of agency and dignity. And I'm starting to hear Joe Biden do that. And let's talk about inflation though for a second. You know, I think it was an extraordinary set of circumstances, right? The war in Ukraine that caused a supply chain crisis that we had never seen before, the pandemic, shutdowns and then reopenings, and then Groundwork Collective, Lindsay Owens leads that, has done some really groundbreaking work showing that in that period, corporate profits accounted for nearly half of inflation. They saw the opportunity and they went for it. And she calls that greedflation. And so there's a number of reasons for inflation. And in fact, the US is in better shape than most large countries today, after the pandemic, after these global supply chain crises, in part because of our post-neoliberal policies. Now, I can say that till I'm blue in the face, but if people who cannot afford to put gas in their car to get to work, that doesn't matter. They can't afford the gas. If people can't afford rent, and they had rental assistance a few years ago during these extraordinary policies, which I hope we'll get into over the course of the pandemic, now no longer can afford rent, that feels terrible and makes people feel both ashamed and deflated, and certainly not inspired to come out and vote. So I agree that it's a lot of work to do, but I also think that our post-neoliberal policies are the reason America is on a better recovery path than most large countries. And that is something we need to, that's a story we need to tell.
Okay, so that's really interesting. So I'll get to that in a quick second to kind of go over like what actually from 2020 onwards, because I think in many ways you could argue that certain aspects of like the Trump era COVID response constituted like post-neoliberal thought. So this could be a bipartisan thing. But I guess what I would ask you is, you gave a good political answer there. You gave the policy articulation, but then you also made clear that, look, if it'd be terrible political advice to tell people, to anyone who worries about inflation, tell them Bidenomics is coming to the rescue. That just politically has not been an effective message. And it just frankly speaks to the impact of the overturning of Roe v. Wade and frankly the political weakness of the Republican Party itself, that there just has not been more of an impact on that inflation discussion. So I guess my real question for you though would be, how do you suggest that post-neoliberal thinkers of the left and right how, because this isn't just like a left-wing thing, to be clear, with me talking about Joe Biden. I was recently at a dinner where a couple of new right people who are really interested in the child tax credit were being attacked by more traditional conservatives as just being big government spenders. They're like, oh, you talk about family policy, but really you're just doing liberalism of a different face. So this is not just a Joe Biden problem. This is a problem that basically so many thinkers, left, right, and center, are going to have a real answer to. What do you think is the, and you don't have to have a perfect story here, but over the next few years, like, where do you really suggest that at a political level, folks who are interested in these new ideas think about bringing inflation? It's just going to be an underlying fear. In the same way that people who grew up during the Depression had, like, for the next 30 years of their politics, like a real underlying fear of that sort of economic catastrophe, I think amongst like certain Gen Xers, millennials, and my cohort and Zoomers, there's just going to be a real careful, you don't want inflation to happen again. So like, how do you think about that problem?
Yeah. I recently got to hear some workers in the South who are part of a new manufacturing plant that's coming out of some of the IRA acceleration and some of the and funding, some of the industrial policy of this administration. And they were part of a union, part of LIUNA. And they were talking about what it meant to now be making $25 an hour with benefits. And it was extraordinary to see the optimism and possibility on their faces. They talked about Invisalign for the kids, putting down a down payment on a home for their mother, which was something they had always dreamt of and never thought would be possible inside of the economic opportunity in that small town in the South. Totally changed by this industrial policy that was coming in. That's the answer to inflation. That is the answer to the rising cost of living, is to invest in jobs, to invest in families, to invest in workers, and help people feel what it would feel like. If we had the expanded child tax credit today, which we don't have because of one Democrat and every Republican, that would yet be another answer to how families are to deal with inflation while we're handling the macro situation. So I think that we know what the answers are. We just have to keep doing more of them. And you know, the political machinery is not really allowing for that. I want to go back to your point about Trump. You know, I actually think that there was so much about in Trump's sort of arguments that was about, you know, making it in the United States that really broke with the neoliberal orthodoxy, very clearly did. The problem was he was so inchoate that it didn't ladder up to any sort of news story. And the racism and the xenophobia made it impossible for the half of the Americans who believe in, or I'll say more than half, Americans who believe in the multiracial project in which we're a part of, the building a multiracial democracy in the 21st century, impossible to hear. So I do think he launched Operation Warp Speed, which was saying, this is how we're going to build the fastest vaccine in America. Obviously broke with orthodoxy around trade policy, but it would be Joe Biden, the most moderate of the bunch, of a pretty extraordinary primary in 2020, right? If you are left of center, you had an extraordinary amount of ideas and new entrants into the space, candidates of color, women, men, an openly gay candidate, all running with all kinds of new ideas they were bringing to the front, including a bunch of guarantee ideas. People were running on a guarantee of housing. People were running on a guarantee of free college, debt-free college in America. Once again, returning to the idea that it's a public good and not something that individuals should have to take out massive amounts of debt to fund. And it would be the most moderate of the bunch, Joe Biden, who would win. And precisely because Joe Biden is pre-neoliberal, right? He, by virtue of the fact he's 81, he remembers an era where government played a really different role in the checks and balances in our democracy and our economy of trade unions, played a different role in industrial policy and investing in families. And so he would be the one to govern during the pandemic, and he would usher in what I think is a very clear story of a new role that government can play to support families, and then get the opportunity in the political opening that it created to pass a lot of these things.
And per you setting this up, I'd love for you just to go over beyond, let's say, 2021 onwards, like what were those post-neoliberal policies that were pursued? And then that way, listeners could kind of like do a checklist in their head of like, okay, did I like that? Did I not like this? Like what actually happened basically from 2021 to 2023 before Democrats lost the House?
Well, I think people should read my book to get the full picture of it. The Guarantee Inside the Fight for America's Next Economy comes out April 23rd. But I'll give you a few for sure, which is in the unimaginable moment of the pandemic chaos, we had tremendous suffering and loss, but we also had an administration poised to move things forward. And we had ideas that had been tested and tried within the laboratories of democracy with cities and states across America that would be picked up and moved on. So here are a few examples, right? We saw the government mobilize the National Guard to put free vaccines in people's arms, to create a net that is Medicaid, enabled by Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act, to be there when tens of millions of people would lose their jobs overnight and also their healthcare coverage, they would fall into Medicaid. And it would result in the lowest number of uninsured Americans in American history. That is a healthcare guarantee. We would see the government buy hotels and move the unhoused in, giving people a room of their own with a key to the room. We would see a historic eviction moratorium that would hold people in their homes. We would see rental subsidies, mortgage subsidies to support people staying in their homes during this extraordinary economic disruption. So all of that points toward a housing guarantee. We would also see a lot more housing production start to happen during this period. The government would create YIMBY grants to support more, and YIMBY being yes in my backyard, sort of this sense that we're 6 million units short in America. We need to be building more. We need to ease a lot of the regulations, and NIMBY, the not in my backyard forces that are standing in the way. All of that would point toward a housing guarantee. We saw government ensure that nobody would pay on their student loans for years. So each month, student debtors had more room to breathe. And then they would outright cancel millions of dollars, billions of dollars of student debt, getting us closer to a college guarantee. So that means people who are walking around, who've done what the American mythology told us to do, go get a college degree, but with a ball and chain around their neck because it is so unaffordable. As we're talking, college is $100,000 now in some places. That is not affordable for so many families. So that would get us closer to a college guarantee. And the last I'll say is we saw government send checks to every family in America through the expanded child tax credit, which is an income guarantee.
I'm really interested by all of those different guarantees. I've written them all down so we can go through some of them. But I'm interested in the college one because I think the college one is the one where my most like conservative parts of my personality just kind of come out in the sense that, so for example, let me just take a look at the list here. So we've got housing, healthcare, dignified work, family care, and inheritance and income floor. I think my real problem with the college education guarantee is it's the one that I think feels like such an endorsement of a specific vision of higher education that I don't think there's an actual consensus on, and I'm really wary of. So here's what I really mean by that. You referenced this when you said there are all these people who took on hundreds of thousands of dollars in debt, have this like real non-bankruptcy dischargeable ball and chain around their leg. I think that's very much true, but like you yourself used the word kind of myth. So it's unclear to me that our modern conception of college makes sense. By the way, this isn't the lazy like micro, everyone should do like a dirty job thing, which I'm just like really over and I don't want to hear. It's not that I don't want to hear, but like if you hear a narrative for 12 years straight and nothing changes, maybe we accept the fact that the narrative might not be true to a certain degree in terms of yes, motivating people to think about things differently. But I guess what I kind of really mean here is that I just worry if we focus on guaranteeing college for all, then we're leaning into a college first model that no one feels really satisfied with, separate from just the overall cost. So I'm curious how you kind of, because frankly, like, of your guarantees, I think that's actually the one which like the conservative Republican parts of the audience will probably have like the most visceral reaction to, even a little more than healthcare, which you could kind of find different ways to say in different categories. So I'm just curious how you think about this.
Are you saying college first, meaning not trade schools and other ways of making a living? Is that your point?
Yeah. So this is good because I think my thank you. Like that was more of a comment slash question than a pure question. I guess what I'd really say is I'd be a lot happier with a college education guarantee if we kind of changed the wording to like a higher education guarantee.
Yeah.
Because if you tell people, look, clearly just going to high school, especially given like grade inflation and a variety of issues you have, clearly isn't enough to really be compatible with the economy. You're going to need some form of post K-12 education.
Yeah.
And therefore we should make it more financially sustainable, or we should make it so everyone could do it. So that can be apprenticeships. That could be community college. That could be a certificate. Yes. I'm just very wary of people hearing a college guarantee and thinking, okay, we're going to repeat this 1980s and beyond story of like, what's our answer to all this economic anxiety? Everyone go to college and we'll make this work because the government's going to pay the bill. I think if we just basically blanketly take that approach, the costs will continue to explode. You're going to have the diploma divide resentments. This is going to come down to a story about what weird stuff that's happening in Ivy League colleges instead of the fact that like most people in this country like go to community colleges and commuter schools. So like the Harvard story isn't the only story. But that's just kind of like a real, having spoken to a lot of conservatives on this issue, that's just sort of like an editorial point I would like to make there, which is that like I just don't want, I think when too many democratic socialists talk about college for all, they are speaking from their personal experiences, having gone to these like universities where they had to pay these high prices, not quite understanding that there's a huge portion of the electorate that needs to be won over and actually is quite populist that has no interest in that four-year higher ed model. And frankly, wouldn't want to fund it or take it themselves. So that's just like kind of like a modification. So I'm curious like how you think about like that dynamic and your conversations with people on the ground.
Marshall, I love this modification. So now we're in a conversation about how to guarantee higher ed, not if we should. And that is the conversation I want to be in. So yes to all your modifications. Let's write a piece together on this and advocate for it because it's totally true. I mean, I tell my son, he's 11, you know, be an electrician. That's the job that you should have in the future as we enter into this world of AI and to disruptions in the workforce. Like, we're going to need to electrify everything to solve the climate crisis. That is a really good job. That's not a job you need to go to an Ivy League school for. That's a job you need an apprenticeship, ideally within a trade union, to get. So yes to your modifications. And my point I'm making is that there was a period of time in America where we saw higher ed, and I would even argue apprenticeships and trade schools, as a public good. It was good for society, for our children to be educated, for our children to have a road to both critical thinking, but also to jobs. And we have the neoliberal story, the neoliberal era, told us a different story, which is that it was a personal investment we were supposed to make as individuals in our children that then would pay some return in the future. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. We had an entire generation of stagnant wages and a pretty significant economic growth that would all go to a very small number of people during that time. So a college degree no longer pays off, and yet it's seen as a personal investment. I want to get us back to a world where it's a public good. And in fact, there's a history of this, right? In California, where I live, you had the architect of higher education as a public good, Clark Kerr, who would really make the UC system into something extraordinary, the University of California system into something extraordinary. He'd be fired by Ronald Reagan, one of the earliest, neoliberal policymakers. And that is just one example of how our higher education system would be dismantled and a bill of goods would be sold to us that it's our, you know, job to take out debt that we may never pay off in our lifetime. But that's actually the path to the American dream.
I'm curious then, within this vision, how do you think government, the taxpayer, et cetera, should conceive? Actually, let me take two more questions on this, then we'll go to another topic. But top line, Can you give me a real articulation of what the higher ed ecosystem would look like under this vision? In the sense that, obviously, I don't think your pitch is quite like, and guess what? Under our program, like everyone gets a degree at Harvard. It's that we're really analyzing the role that like public institutions, that's why your reference to UC Berkeley really matters. There's the apprenticeship programs, there's the labor unions, like there's maybe like a partnership that you do while someone's still actually in high school. There's all these different models. Just give us a real articulation of how you see the ecosystem evolving under this guarantee, where we're reconceiving this not just as a personal investment, which the government is just genuinely backing through guaranteed loans, but is just actually a public good that everyone's going to benefit from. So I'd love to hear what that, because I think that's, I think so many of the objections that people on the right are going to really have is just believing that you're saying, hey, let's take this current system that no one's actually happy with and just make it free, quote unquote. So what really changes in this way you're thinking about this?
Well, I think the first, the easiest place to start would be our public institutions. I grew up in Kansas, and Kansas University, the University of Kansas and Kansas State University are beloved institutions that were once, you know, our land grant school and KU, right? They were once much more affordable and now have spiraled out of control. The costs have, like almost every other public institution. So, you know, I would start there, but I absolutely think you're right that it's, if we're really going to believe that this is the path forward, it's a time to reimagine what's possible, to reimagine how we school. You know, the other thing I'll say is that over decades, universities have, as we've moved into the personal investment model of education, universities have had to compete in a much more significant way. And that means building like big fancy gyms and state-of-the-art buildings, all to entice the student who's going to pay a very, very large amount of money to go there. And I don't think it needs to be that way. We should focus on the education. That said, this is not an area where I'm an expert. And I'll say there's people like Tressie McMillan Cottom, the New York Times columnist, who's written a book on private schools and indicting them, and others who I'd point to say, what is the path forward on higher education, one that reimagines what's possible and gets us back to a place that we know can work in the United States of America because it once did.
I'd love for you to talk about the seventh of your guarantees, which is the income floor, which folks will think of as universal basic income. I would love to ask you this question because, and I know you worked on this policy heavily, so I mean no offense with this question, but like at a narrative level, clearly there's been a bit of like rise and fall when it comes to universal basic income. Very, very edgy and exciting in the late 2010s. Andrew Yang, who obviously isn't a successful presidential candidate, but really like when he's, I remember I was working at PBS when he was first sending his pitches out, and it was all about UBI. And that was like a very like compelling reality and background matter. What can the story of the rise and fall of UBI as a priority issue on the center right and center left teach us about advancing new ideas in the face of shifting economic paradigms? Or maybe you think that I'm just totally wrong and kind of not dismissing the policy, but kind of saying highs and lows in terms of relevancy and excitement around it.
So let me tell you a counter story. A young student would sit at the Stanford Library reading Dr. King's last book, making notes in the margins, scrawling notes in the margins. His name was Michael Tubbs. He would bring that dog-eared copy of Dr. King's last book to Stockton, California, where he would become one of the youngest mayors in American history in Stockton. It's there where I'd meet him. And the Economic Security Project would team up with Mayor Tubbs to launch the first demonstration of guaranteed income in the United States in Stockton, California. It was a radical idea, but here's how it played out. 125 families would receive $500 a month with no strings attached. It's not actually that radical. It's pretty simple, in fact, and efficient and smart. And those families experienced the agency and freedom for a bit that comes with just a bit more economic security. So a bunch of mayors would text around the country and say, hey, I want in on that. What? Bring me in. What are you doing here? How do I do that in my city? And he would launch Mayors for a Guaranteed Income. Over 100 mayors would join. Half of them would run demonstrations or pilots of this idea in their own cities. And you'd have the 2020 primary. You referenced Andrew Yang. Also Kamala Harris then. Then Senator Kamala Harris, who was running for president at the time, would run on something called the LIFT Act, which was a tax policy reconception that would put $500 a month with no strings attached into about half of Americans' pockets. And then the pandemic would hit, and Joe Biden and the administration and Congress would reach for ideas that were already tested. You had, at this point, mayors all across the country testing this idea out. They'd reach for it, and they would pass it as the expanded child tax credit. For if you have two young children, it's basically $500 a month with no strings attached directly into your bank account. So that, I think, is a case study of how the idea was there, it was picked up, and it was moved forward. And I think it's one that, while it may not be the hot new thing, like you say it was in the late tens, I would say that we've seen extraordinary movement despite Congress being in gridlock and unable to move the expanded child tax credit forward, largely due to Republican intransigence. We know that at the state level, we've seen states adopt the child tax credit. We've doubled the number of states, red states, blue states, purple states. We've doubled the number of states with the child tax credits on the books, and we're hoping to triple it by 2025. So momentum is moving forward, whether or not it's in the media headlines. And I know enough to know it's going to come back around, and we'll be ready this time with a much larger army than we were in the past.
I like that answer, because I think you made clear that we should not just interpret these seven guarantees in your book as like a policy proposal, but there's actually like a philosophical idea behind them. So like, maybe you didn't see Congress during the pandemic pass universal basic income, but ideas that are embedded within that universal basic income floor were integrated into both like pandemic supports, but also the child tax credit. So that's very well taken. Here's the question though, and I think this really gets to the core of this. This is why I'm glad you brought up Michael Tubbs. So Michael Tubbs famously did not win re-election in 2020. There's some like complicating factors there. Around like maybe he wasn't doing enough of a good job doing like the small town mayor, balancing the HBO documentaries. There's some good political articles on this. But when you combine
and also
that,
just to say a total media desert. The newspaper gone belly up, and a blog that had zero journalistic integrity, the primary local news source. So that election was about a lot more than what the national media understood.
No, totally. And I guess the reason why I just bring this up though is that famously, so he loses re-election.
Yeah.
Despite really pioneering the UBI work. And then at the same time, you see the real serious child tax credit expansion be shut down in Congress eventually to zero political cost for the Republicans and then the Democrat who didn't support the renewal. I bring this up because Rui Teixeira, who is the famous Democratic Party, he's kind of like center right now, but that's a separate issue in his marketing.
Realignment,
but like
baby.
He's this like longstanding like Democratic Party, like pollster and political analyst. And he wrote this book called What Happened to the Democrats. I had him on the show, and Ezra Klein had him on the show. And during their interview, Roy really focused on like neoliberalism as a cost, as a political cost for Democrats. And Ezra made like a really smart point that like I actually was kind of getting at in my interview, but he just made a little more concretely, which is the following. Look, you could argue that neoliberal approaches are bad. They hollow out the economy. They leave us less resilient in the face of a pandemic. I told you this before the interview, I focus on the national security space. If you're worried about America's ability to stand up to authoritarian powers in China and Russia, you should freak out about the fact that we allowed Wall Street to hollow out our defense industrial base during the 1990s. Like, there's something for everyone there. So that's like the policy side of this. But as Ezra pointed out, I could agree with that policy take while also believing, hey, during the era of neoliberalism, the Democratic Party won 7 out of 8 popular vote elections. And actually, the Democratic Party during the era of neoliberalism, even late stage neoliberalism, is probably stronger at a pure like coalitional level, the combination of minority voters, moderate suburban voters. They're taking the country club Republicans. So the reason why I was bringing up the UBI political example and the child tax credit example, is there ever going to be a point, because this is how I think paradigms actually change, where making these moves and these guarantees won't just be good policy ideas, because there are lots of great policy ideas that aren't adopted, but will actually give you political benefit therein. Because my theory of change is, you know, running like a think tank is actually like a really key thing. My theory of change is you need good policy, but you also need relatively like apolitical, or not, they're very political, but relatively policy uninterested, normie Democrats, Republicans, state legislators, et cetera, to say like, yeah, this is going to be a good idea because this makes me look good. How do you think about that dilemma that I'm trying to establish here?
That's a great question. And I think that...
Stolen from Ezra, obviously, but stolen from Ezra. But you don't have a perfect answer, but it's like a fascinating idea that I'd really like to chew on.
Yeah, as would I. I think that, you know, if you take the example of the child tax credit, it was good policy. It was excellent policy. Like the numbers are unequivocal, right? 3.7 million children lifted out of poverty, $8 return for every $1 spent on the child tax credit in economic and social benefit to society. 21% of parents say they were going to start a business as those checks started to come in and just give them a little bit more room. You know, parents were 1.3 times more likely, to our earlier point about trade, associate trade school and others, were to pursue a professional development course in some way. So the numbers were extraordinary, not to mention, of course, cutting child poverty in half. And so it was good policy, but it was also good politics. People were resonant with the idea. The checks were something that were very popular. Our polling shows that they were popular among parents on both sides of the aisle. Republican parents were incredibly supportive of them. Democratic parents were supportive of them. They just didn't have enough time to keep going. And 6 months, it turns out, was not enough time to build the case for something that actually, as simple as it sounds, was a radical shift in how we'd done economic policy in the past, to send a check to every parent with no strings attached. Now, if you go to any other large economy, they have a child allowance. That is a thing. They're in fact shocked that American parents raise children without a child allowance. So we're on our own in many ways in that, on that front. But still, so your point is, how does it become good policy and good politics? And you also, point I'm taking, there was zero political, and I wouldn't say there was zero, but there was not a political cost for letting the child tax credit expire.
Versus something like Social Security. If you act like, I know Republican policies, like political circles, the number of Republicans who like in private would say in Congress, they think Social Security is a bad Ponzi scheme, big government, is actually very, 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 very high. But everyone kind of fakes that they agree with the consensus because the political costs are just too actually high to not support that policy. So like, my question is like, how do you translate something like this into the Social Security category?
Well, one is that you have to have it for longer than 6 months. And so the idea that we'd be like, well, that didn't work, and wash our hands off despite the numbers being so extraordinary and move on. It's not the way things work in politics. It requires persistence and pushing. Let's take Social Security, for example, right? The idea was it took a long time to gear up in the United States. I was actually fascinated and dug into this. There was a doctor, Dr. Townsend, who was looking at post-war Germany. He was living in Southern California. He was shocked at the older people who were retired and moved to Southern California to live the life that they had dreamed of and had worked hard for, and the Great Depression would wipe out all of their savings. And he said, there has to be a better way. So he looked at the post-war Germany and said, let's do that. So he started Townsend Clubs. This is before the internet, before Twitter, before Discord, before WhatsApp. And these clubs proliferated around the country, advocating for an old age pension. And he had a very specific policy idea laid out, and it was all done via mail and, you know, in-person visits. And it really pushed the idea forward to where it would become Social Security as we understand it. And over the decades, to your point, it would become something that people would not touch and would grow and grow. It started as a small payroll tax and would grow and grow into the Social Security, you know, we know today. We had 6 months with the child tax credit. So I will say, I think the pilots that are happening around the country could not be more important. They are led by people like Cook County Commissioner Tony Preckwinkle, who, this is Cook County, is the county of Chicago. Tony Preckwinkle is a visionary public servant, and she's launched one of the largest guaranteed income demonstrations in the country. And she wants to keep it permanent until we see a, you know, federal guaranteed income or an expanded child tax credit. And story after story comes out about what it means for families in Chicago. And people are staking their political careers on this. So I think that we will come back. There will be a moment where we can push for the expanded child tax credit. It might be the end of 2025 when the Trump tax cuts expire, and this nation will be in a very large conversation about tax policy and what it means. And a reminder that tax policy is a moral document reflecting our values as a society. And that might be the moment. But until then, cities and states are leading the way.
So the last big question here, this is kind of the political philosophy question. What's your theory of change when it comes to getting Americans, or at least a 50 plus one, or maybe even a 60 plus one majority of Americans, comfortable with the idea of guarantees in this context? Because if you're listing out previous guarantees we've offered, they've been very, I don't want to say transactional in a negative way, but like very specifically, right? Like FDR, when he's making the case for Social Security, is making clear that, oh, this is not just an entitlement. This is a system that you are paying into. This isn't something for nothing. Like this is, once again, us using collective action to solve that problem you illustrated with Dr. Townsend. Think of the GI Bill, like one of like, let's put aside like racial exclusion and all those things, but just at a policy level, the idea of these veterans who fought their way across the Pacific and Western Europe, let's get them access to the American dream, not only through higher education, but also by housing and getting them suburban households in the Levittons, and we'll build Levittowns and we'll build highways. That was in exchange for something. I think it's pretty clear that when you're talking with these ideas, like the no strings attached is actually not only a philosophical argument, but kind of part of like the point that if you like means test, if like, for example, during the pandemic, talk about the falling child poverty numbers, if we'd means tested to death the child tax credit, it would defeat the entire purpose of actually pursuing that. So can you just like kind of introduce why Americans in these additional categories should be comfortable with a guarantee that's a little different than the way we've approached these issues in the past?
I think that's a really
quick pause. And even what's funny is, and higher ed is actually a little separate from this, because even in your answer, you were talking about how it's a public good. So that was actually pretty clear. It's like, look, we as a society will be better off via your son becoming an electrician or like a union member keeping a society together. So that was like kind of like its own category. But what about the other ones? I'm really curious about that.
Yeah, I think this is a great question. Probably one of the most fundamental questions of our time in so many ways. What I'll offer is this, that unless people have economic security, it is very hard to live a life of agency, a life of dignity, and a life of with that has presence and attention. You know, one of the things we heard with even the baseline economic security of the child tax credit checks, with a little extra money coming in each month, was that parents felt like they could provide for their families in a more meaningful way. They felt like they could say yes as a parent. They could show up and be a better parent, saying yes to something like a carton of raspberries at the grocery store, even though you know that $8 carton of raspberries is not going to fit in the budget this time, but you could bring one home just this time, right? That agency is the agency that, you know, families who have economic security get to live with every single day. And that frankly, it is a public good that people have a floor in this country. I think that's the path forward for democracy. We have been in a downward spiral of trust, where, you know, people have been told it's your responsibility to make it in this country, to take out the debt, to work for $7.25 an hour, work 2, 3, 4 jobs. And when they don't make it, they feel shame. Shame that they can't show up for their families in the way they want to. Shame they can't show up for their churches, for their institutions, for the PTA. And it makes it hard to trust when we feel shame. And when we can't trust institutions, we can't trust, and it makes it hard to see democracy flourish in that way. That's a downward spiral. I think there is a possibility for an upward spiral where there's more economic security in people's lives. They have more time, attention, agency and can trust more, can lean in, be part of the institutions, lean in to democracy, and you start to, and it widens the pie of economic growth. Because if they're engaged in voting, we know what happens when people show up. You know, when the guarantees are on the ballot in red states, in blue states, or in purple states, when we see paid sick leave, when we see increases in minimum wage on the ballot, they pass. People support the guarantees. And when there is you could see an upward spiral that I think is the hope I have for building this multiracial democracy in America, one that's never been tried, never been done before in the world.
You know, I just had this moment that we'll close with where I was like, and that's why your organization is called the Economic Security Project. Because I was just thinking, like, I mentioned this before we started the episode, like my actual like expertise and day job is in the foreign policy space. And as I'm thinking back to what you were saying around the effect of the pandemic on inflation, the effect of Russia's invasion of Ukraine on energy prices and also inflation, the fact that, you know, Houthi rebels are like launching attacks on like global trade right now. We actually live in a world where I think individuals are going to be really just buffeted by these greater forces. Once again, wars, invasions, all these different policies. And there's a real opportunity politically to make clear that these guarantees in your articulation are really necessary in this moment in a way that maybe, look, if it's the end of history, 1990s, and everything's peaceful and like we're confident that like economic growth is just going to kind of go on forever the way it's going, and that the internet's going to make everyone a millionaire, Dow hit 36,000, maybe you don't need all of this. But very clearly, we no longer live in an environment that looks like that. So I'd really ask listeners who are skeptical of these ideas or have their own little quibbles, left, right, or center, to really think hard about, if the world doesn't look like the world of the 1980s and the world looks like the world of the 2020s, how should we conceive of government's roles and the role of a guarantee? Because I think if we just treat these as like abstractly philosophical, that's less useful than just thinking to ourselves, hey, let's say China invades Taiwan, separate from whether or not the US intervenes, that would create a enormous geopolitical economic disaster. Trade embargoes, talk about like a China shock to the trade system vis-a-vis 2020. In that environment, you're going to have the government intervene when it comes to actual families. Like if we're worried about inflation from a Russian invasion of like Ukraine, like 2027 Taiwan, that inflation would be even bigger. So as a national security person, I start thinking like, okay, maybe we need to reconceive of government's role when it comes to how actual individuals and families experience these broader trends. So this was a really great conversation, Natalie. Thank you for letting me think out loud. And this has been fun.
Marshall, it's really a joy to get to think out loud with you. I'm grateful for the time.
And the book is The Guarantee. We're airing this on publication, so y'all can find this on the bookshop where we get 10% preferably, but you could also go to Amazon and any of your other local booksellers.
Awesome. Thanks so much.
Hope you enjoyed this episode. If you learned something, like the sort of mission, or want to access our subscriber-exclusive Q&A, bonus episodes, and more, go to realignment.supercast.com and subscribe to our $5 a month, $50 a year, or $500 for lifetime membership rates. See you all next time.